Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of CAF Chats, presented by the Academic Department Crim Law here at TJAGLICS. Today we have the famous Lieutenant Colonel Seagraves with us, maybe one of his last podcasts, sir. And we also have 1L intern Patricia Taylor here with us as well, who's interning here at TJAGLICS. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, sir.
All right, so today we are talking about United States versus Wilson, number 230225. This is a case from CAF. We have some interesting opinions here, so let's go ahead and dive right in. Patricia, do you have the facts for us?
Yes, so in this case, Staff Sergeant Wilson was accused of sexually assaulting and abusing two young girls, which included his daughter and his neighbor. Appellant's daughter claimed that her father started to sexually abuse her when she was 5 years old and that the abuse continued for several years. And this abuse mainly consisted of oral and anal penetration, as well as other non-penetrative acts. Also, appellant was accused of having sexual intercourse with his 12-year-old neighbor. So, while investigating these charges, law enforcement found a journal in appellant's master bedroom that contained, quote, handwritten, graphic, and highly sexualized stories. Appellant even admitted to law enforcement that the journal belonged to him and that he wrote the stories later on in the investigation. These stories centered around adults and minors and parents and their children engaging in sexual acts. Notably, the journal included a story where the main character named Mr. Wilson had sexual intercourse with his neighbor who was a minor at the time. This story and many others closely resembled the charged offenses in this case.
And so, Patricia, what are we looking at here? What is CAF looking at in this case?
Well, they're mainly focusing on the procedural history of this case where things start to get a bit complicated. So before the GCM, the military judge issued a pretrial order requiring the government to provide notice of all the evidence it intended to introduce under 404B.
In 404B, Colonel Seagraves, could you just give us a quick rundown of that to kind of lay the foundation for us here?
Well, James, as you like to do and instruct your students to do, I've pulled out my manual for court-martial.
Sir, there's a tear in my eye.
So, looking at Military Rule of Evidence 404, specifically B, it's other crimes, wrongs, or acts. And under that, we have prohibited uses. Evidence of any other crime, wrong, or act is not admissible to prove a person's character in order to show that on a particular occasion, that person acted in accordance with the character. So, basically, we don't want any disposition type of evidence. We don't want to say somebody's, you know, a bad person, so they acted badly.
Once a thief, always a thief.
That's right. So we do have permitted uses, though. So going forward, the permitted uses for this 404B evidence is it may be admissible for another purpose, such as proving motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, absence of mistake, or lack of accident. And if you prepared for the bar, you've already looked at that probably as either mimic or some evidence professors go with a kipomia.
And sir, could you just, for the audience, to tease out just a little bit the difference between actual character evidence and then using this other act to show something else, like you've already talked about, the intent.
So with character evidence under 404A, you'd be looking for some sort of pertinent character trait that'd be relevant to a crime. So if somebody was charged with an assault, the fact that they have a character for being violent or perhaps hot-headed could come into play if they tried putting on a defense of self-defense or something like that. Or a defendant could bring on the character for violence or hot-headedness of the alleged victim in a case to defend themselves. But in this case, for 404B, for the purposes for the government to use these types of things, well, especially what we're going to talk about here, you'd be looking at things like motive. Did they have a reason for doing this thing? And can we bring on some evidence to show that? And we'll be talking about that in a minute. Or we'll hear about intent, which goes towards the state of mind of a person. What are they actually trying to do when they do something?
So, for example, not skip ahead. In this case, by writing the journal, we're talking about the act of writing, not what writing the journal says about the person. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think it's fair.
Patricia, continue, if you would.
Of course. So the deadline for the 404B evidence in this case was 26 October 2020. And although the government provided notice of the evidence it sought to admit at trial, the trial counsel failed to include appellant's journal on the list. And later, on 16 November 2020, the government attempted to pre-admit the journal under MRA 401 and 402, claiming that the journal was direct evidence of appellant's intent to engage in sexual behaviors with minors. Despite its attempts, the government eventually conceded that it sought to introduce the journal to demonstrate Mr. Wilson's motive and intent under 404B.
And this occurred during that motions hearing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And Colonel Seagrave, sir, remind us again, 404B requires the proponent of the evidence to do what?
They have to give notice. And that's actually, 404B has recently changed and really just even highlighted that even more. So basically, again, looking at the book here, must provide reasonable notice of any such evidence that the trial counsel intends to offer at trial so the accused has a fair opportunity to meet it. Articulate in this notice the permitted purpose for which the trial counsel intends to offer the evidence and the reasoning that supports the purpose, and do so in writing before trial or in any form during trial if the court for good cause excuses this lack of pretrial notice.
Thank you. So it sounds like in this case there may not have been formal notice, but it certainly was litigated before the military judge, correct?
Yes, it was litigated during an Article 39A session, and a few months later, the military judge overruled the defense's objections, and the journal was eventually admitted during the GCM.
And how was this issue disposed of? Because this is not the main holding of this case, but how was this issue disposed of, the notice issue disposed of by the CAF?
So basically, non-issue. As I said, didn't violate the rules for 404B. The 404B itself, as you just heard me say, they have to give pre-trial notice, as long as they're on notice before trial. And here, the government did violate the trial management order of the military judge. They missed the date for the original notice to provide it. However, 6 months beforehand, had the motions hearing. So, and again, just to step back for a second, a 39A session for viewers out there or listeners out there, that's any session of the court outside of the purview of the members. The trier fact is not there. So during this 39A session, this motions hearing, they litigated the motion. As Patricia said, the government tried to pre-admit under 401 and 402 this evidence, which, just in practice, Patricia, I'm going to tell you, military judges don't like to pre-admit things. I always ask my students here to try to do motions in limine to ask for a ruling on the admissibility. And pretty much like the judge did here, they'll say, okay, as long as you lay the foundation during trial itself, we'll make a final ruling, but it's probably going to be admissible. And that's what he ruled there. And so, yes, they should have said 404B. They should have provided notice specifically under 404B. But the CAF says, hey, that's on the military judge to enforce those orders. In the end, no real violation because they knew before trial.
And they essentially litigated it prior. So, okay, let's move on then. So we're dealing with a journal that details certain writings. And here we're arguing about motive and intent. Colonel Seagraves, talk to us about what we call the Reynolds test.
Of course, James. So the big landmark case is Reynolds. And so when we look at the admissibility of 404B evidence, we have to look at the Reynolds factors. And number one is whether the evidence reasonably supports that the appellant committed the acts at issue. And it's a very low threshold. It's a question of, could the finders of fact find by preponderance that this person did these acts? The Reynolds factor number two, whether a fact of consequence is made more probable by the existence of this evidence. And that's basically, you're just MRE 401, your logical relevance. Is some matter at issue in this case, is it made more or less probable? Very low threshold. Does it move the needle at all? And then we look at Reynolds factor number 3, whether the probative value of the evidence was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And that's your MRE 403 legal relevance question that can be brought for any piece of evidence.
And just a, we'll call it a pet peeve for me, but remember out in the field that if you're making a 403 objection, 403 keeps out relevant evidence, which is why the 403 analysis comes after, in this case in the Reynolds test, after you've established relevance and what you're using it for. So that's very important. A lot of practitioners out there want to go straight to 403. You should start off with relevance and then build your objection from there if you're the government or defense. Sorry to interrupt you, sir.
Oh, no. I mean, as long as we're giving quick tips in the middle of this thing, I tell every student of mine, if you're going to make a relevance objection, object, pause, wait for the judge to call on you, ask for the basis, say relevance, and ask for a 39A session immediately. Because if the military judge gives the other side an opportunity, they're going to start their closing argument on you. So a little lanyap bonus tip there, listeners.
Yes. So let's kind of get this train back on the tracks. This is what happens when we get away from Major Dustin Morgan and he's not around to keep us reined in. So, all right, back to you, Patricia. How did the court deal with motive and intent here?
So the court had two different rulings for this. In regards to the motive, the court found that the military judge's decision to admit the journal did not constitute an abuse of discretion. However, they did find that the decision to admit the journal on the grounds of intent was an abuse of discretion. And so they went through the 403 analysis with that to determine whether or not having the journal in front of the panel in this case had a substantial prejudicial effect. And after doing their analysis, CAF decided that even though the journal entries were inflammatory in nature, ACCA's decision should be upheld because the evidentiary error did not have a substantial influence on the findings or the sentence in this case.
So in other words, no prejudice.
There you go.
So, sir, Colonel Seagraves, so we're talking, for those of you that read the case and those of you that should read the case, you'll see that there's numerous, we'll call it, opinions within it. It's over 20 pages. Certain justices are signing on to certain parts, not signing on to certain parts. But it appears from looking at it all, everybody... and I won't speak for Mags because he says that there's just no prejudice and that's the only analysis that we should have done. But I think it appears that the majority of the justices say, one, it's we can tell that this guy wrote the journal, or at least that they provided enough evidence to get over that hurdle. Two, that it was relevant. And then it's where the court begins to, I'm not even going to call it fracturing, but begins to take different approaches is when we start talking about the 403 analysis. And can you kind of walk us through that, sir?
Yeah, we'll just go through the Reynolds factors real quick.
Yes, sir.
So number one, whether evidence reasonably supports the appellant committed the acts at issue. Okay, as you said, super easy. Found it in his bedroom. It was dedicated to his wife. And then, of course, like so many of our clients when we're in defense, he makes a statement and he admits that it's his. So, okay, pretty dang easy on that one. All right, but now we're looking at two. Okay, what fact of consequence is made more probable by the existence of this evidence? And that's where we start doing the kind of the split here. We have the motive and we have the intent. Okay, and with motive, you know, these salacious stories of sex between adults and children, you know, have a lot of similarities. Specifically, in one story, the appellant gave the adult character his own last name. Okay, that's pretty relevant right there. In another story, the adult character was a soldier and a doctor, while the appellant himself was a soldier and a combat medic. Again, seeing the similarities there. Van Pelt's stories depicted incestual relationships, and he committed acts on his daughter. So in the end, they're looking at how motive evidence shows that doing an act by a particular person, by evidencing an emotional need in that person, which could have incited or stimulated that person to do that act in satisfaction of that emotion. That's the calf looking at Whitner. So basically, as you said, they all say yes. For again, Emory 401, logical relevance definitely moves the needle in that one. Then we go to intent, and that's where we get some more argument here. And if you listen to the oral arguments, there was a lot of back and forth there on it. Kind of the contrasted Morrison and Harrow, two other opinions of the calf. Essentially, the argument by the appellant is that because these acts were so overt that there was really no question of intent here, of that state of mind, you know, that they knowingly did these things. It was intentional, you know, almost by default. And so the calf says, you know, with Morrison, you know, they said that evidence has some tendency to show intent, but also that the charge acts were so overtly sexual that the motive and intent were not an issue. And in that case, they concluded the proffered evidence was not admissible under that third prong of Reynolds. But in Harrow, in Morrison's in 1999, in Harrow, in 2007, the CAF said evidence of intent may be admitted regardless of whether a defendant argues lack of intent, because every element of a crime must be proven by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt. And they also said, cited an older case, the Court of Military Appeals, 1988, the predecessor of CAF, that intent is at issue because the accused pled not guilty. You know, in the end, the CAF said, hey, we're still in the second prong. We're still in logical relevance here. And so, you know, this book is logically relevant. Again, low threshold for that intent purpose. But now the rubber meets the road when we get to the third prong, the third Reynolds factor, that 403 analysis. And that's where we have a bit of a split, as you said, James.
Yes. The split is revolving around that MRE 403, I believe they call it the right analysis, the right factors, sir?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, you have U.S. v. Wright and also U.S. v. Berry, the two cases. Wright really was the main start of it. And it's interesting because that was really under a 414 case, but they use those factors to analyze the 403 part of it. And so, you know, that's always useful for both military judges and practitioners when they analyze these things. In the end, I'll just kind of skip to it. Yep. You know, they all pretty much agree. Motive, yes. Very, as we said, when we talked about how similar the writings were to the acts, very probative. And because it was so probative, it's not substantially outweighed by any undue, unfair prejudice, confusion issues, etc. But the issue kind of comes in when we start talking about intent. And that's where, you know, they say because the probative value, it's there, it's logically relevant, but it's not super necessary because these acts are just very intentional in nature. And because it has that low probative value for that intent purpose, that then we start looking at, okay, panel members presumably were repulsed by the notion that the appellant was the type of person who would author these types of stories. And that's when you start worrying about that disposition type evidence. You know, can they be confused, or can they conflate the fact that this guy is kind of a quote-unquote icky person? Would they do bad things because he's that type of person? And that's where Caps ruled that there was an abuse of discretion on that 403 balancing of intent.
And to nerd out, as you call it, sir, it's important to note that only two justices, Judge Olson and Judge Hardy, signed on to that portion. You have Judge Sparks, who does not think that the judge abused his discretion in any manner, took some issue with doing a separate 403 analysis for motive and intent, and so he didn't get to prejudice. And then you have Judge Maggs, who says skips over all of that and says there's still just no prejudice here, so we don't have to get involved with whether the judge abused his discretion or not. But again, The other, it's the overlay of abuse of discretion most of the time that these cases are being reviewed on, which for the field and the practitioners out there, it is very incumbent upon you and even military judges to make sure that you are putting on evidence of the facts that you want. You are being very clear and explicit with the law that you are applying, and then you are making arguments that are grounded in those facts and that law to get the best possible outcome at trial, and then get the best possible review for whichever side you are on, because we have a famous philosopher in our department that says good prosecutors get convictions, great prosecutors sustain convictions. Sir, last word on Wilson before we get back over to Patricia to figure out a little bit more about her.
Well, just to wrap it up, again, we look at there being no prejudice, and one of the things they say saves it is that the judge gave those instructions not to use this evidence for that, you know, improper disposition purpose. And we believe that the members listen to and obey the instructions of the judge. So these curative instructions that the judge had, you know, remove that prejudice. We talk about, you know, how can practitioners use this in the field and in the fleet? And so the first thing I just suggest is, you know, trial counsel, you need to begin with the end in mind. So always be thinking about the instructions the judge is going to give at the end. Think about your closing argument. And when we analyze any piece of evidence, just because you got a piece of evidence, okay, I'm going to use it. Okay, for what purpose are we bringing it in? You know, is it like in here? Are we using it for motive? When we think about for what purpose we're using it, you know, that will drive our analysis of what rule of evidence we're going to use, what arguments we're going to make, and then how we're going to write our motions in limine, stomp, stomp of the foot on the ground, please, trial counsel, to get that early ruling on the admissibility, not permitting, ruling on admissibility. And, you know, as an extension of that, thinking about why you're going to use something, remembering that 404B has that, you know, more stringent notice requirement now. And the military judges are really going to put your feet to the fire, trial counsel. So make sure you give that proper notice.
Awesome, sir. Thank you. All right. Patricia, you've been here at TJ Aglix how long?
About 1 month this week, I believe.
And you are a 1L, I believe, in Ohio?
Yes, sir. I go to Case Western Reserve University School of Law.
Okay. And you got here because of the JAG Corps internship?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Tell me about that process.
So I knew going into law school that I loved oral advocacy, I loved doing research, and I had done a few mock trial and moot court competitions beforehand, but I wasn't sure what roles I could do in the future where I would be able to litigate and try cases on a frequent basis. And then I ended up hearing about the JAG Corps 1L summer internship. And after speaking with a few JAGs and learning that you have the opportunity to try cases basically on day one, that really excited me and made me want to go through the internship process and see what it's like to be a judge advocate.
And was this, not to go back a little bit, but was the internship process, application process easy? You met with an FSO, interviewed?
Absolutely. My FSO was extremely helpful. And going through the pre-screening interview with him was really great for me. It helped me to identify what sort of things I wanted to talk about in my application and in the personal statement. So I really recommend people ask a lot of questions during those interviews about the application if they have any questions or concerns.
Awesome. And what are some of the things we've kept you busy with here?
So right now I am working on a post-trial workbook for the graduate course students, and it has been extremely challenging to learn different portions of the UCMJ within 1 month and understand the ins and outs of Article 60A, but it also has been extremely rewarding, and I'm excited to walk away with this knowledge once the summer ends.
And what kind of trips have we been able to get you on here?
We have gone to USALSA for an intern orientation, which was really nice to meet other law students and hear about their interest in the JAG Corps. We also were able to recently go to Fort Gregg Adams and sit in on a paralegal class, which was really cool to see. There are other fun trips in store that I'm super excited about for the next month of this internship.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you. We're really excited to be here with you, and look forward to the next month. And Colonel Seagrave, sir, you are PCSing soon. Is that correct?
Yes, James.
And where's the greener pastures for you, sir?
Well, I'm going to be on the bench at Camp Pendleton, or I'll be out of Camp Pendleton in somewhere on the West Coast in some courtroom ruling on 404B motions, apparently.
That's awesome. Well, we will definitely miss you, sir. I appreciate you handing the podcast off to me, and we'll hopefully get you back for some lessons learned here in the future.
Yeah. Criminals at the Criminal Law Department at TJ Aglix are an amazing team. It's been my honor to be a part of it. I'm just thankful to, you know, Major Steve Dre that got this podcast kicked off. Happy for you, James, and Dustin Morgan and Rhian Wentz to keep it going.
Yes, sir.
It's been something special. Thank you, and thank you, listeners.
It has been. And with that, I'll remind all the listeners out there to, as what does Josh Mickelson say, sir?
Smash that subscribe button.
Smash that subscribe button. Thank you all very much, and we look forward to seeing you for the next episode.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's Corps, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.